lightning in my term. "The issue in front of us, gentlemen," said Holmes, noting that even former Major and Superintendent Brock had turned his attention back from the window, "is the anarchists' plans to assassinate Her Majesty Queen Victoria and the monarchs, emperors, and elected leaders of at least 12 other nations, beginning with the assassination of President Grover Cleveland, on or before this May 1st.
It was Vice President Stevenson who took charge of moderating the outbreak of gabble into a series of questions and answers with a calm Sherlock Holmes at the swirling conversation's locus. "Chief Drummond, how reliable is this intelligence regarding President Cleveland, Mr. Holmes?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"Very reliable, sir."
Chief Drummond: "Are there any specifics to this warning, or is it the usual vague threat?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"The most specific threat to date suggests that President Cleveland will be assassinated on May 1st, the Socialist International Workers' Holiday since the Haymarket Square incident, most probably while he is officially declaring open the Columbian World Exposition in Chicago."
Secretary Rockhill:
"Is this supposed to be another Haymarket Square operation, Mr. Holmes? Mobs? Bombs thrown? Rampant shooting at police as well as at the president?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"That is always possible, but our intelligence suggests that it is more likely to be the work of one or two master assassins hired by the anarchists."
Chief Drummond: "Do we have the identity of those hired assassins?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"We do. Here are photographs of the two men. The older man is probably well known to you, Colonel Sebastian Moran. The younger man is the more able assassin, 20-year-old Lucan Adler. And this photographic plate is the first official photograph of Adler. Please be careful with the glass. Can you make close-up copies from that plate, Chief Drummond?"
Chief Drummond:
"Of course."
Holding Clover Adams's photographic plate up to the light while the other men craned to catch a glimpse of the face.
"Why, this Adler is only a boy."
Sherlock Holmes:
"That photograph was taken almost 7 years ago, gentlemen. Lucan Adler was 13 years old. A boy, as you say. But even at age 13, he was a remarkable hunter and marksman with a rifle, and already trained as an assassin by his guardian, Colonel Sebastian Moran."
Superintendent Brock:
"Who took this photograph of Lucan Adler?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"I'm afraid I cannot reveal that information at this time, but I assure you that the young man in the photograph is indeed Lucan Adler, and that his face, while more angular and more cruel, still looks much the same today."
Chief Drummond:
"How do you know his current appearance, Mr. Holmes?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"I've encountered him in recent years."
Superintendent Brock, laughing derisively:
"What? The famous Sherlock Holmes encountered our assassin, and the fellow is not in custody? How can this be? Are the faculties of the famous detective slipping some with age, sir?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"Lucan Adler stalked me, Mr. Brock. And 2 years ago, he put 3 rifle bullets into me and through me from extremely long range. My survival was pure chance, with some aid from the fact that the bullets were steel jacketed, in the way of military ammunition. So they passed through me rather than tumbled. Had they been ordinary rounds, the softer bullets would have taken out my lungs, heart, and spine."
A long silence ensues. Superintendent Moore:
"On whose evidence, on what basis, are we to believe in this grand anarchist's conspiracy? The May 1 date for the attack on President Cleveland? All of it?"
Sherlock Holmes:
"On the basis, sir, of specific intelligence obtained by Her Majesty's Secret Service. The information has been corroborated by the new Prefect of Police of Paris, Monsieur Louis-Jean-Baptiste Lépine, and by Inspector Annaud of the French Sûreté, as well as through other intelligence gathered by the Belgian and French Secret Services. And finally, gentlemen, We act based on additional information obtained through my own investigations in the 7 years since I provided evidence to the Chicago police regarding the Haymarket Square massacre.
Superintendent Brock.
The general opinion in the United States, Mr. Holmes, is that the Haymarket trial was a one-sided farce. Headed by an unfair judge and overzealous prosecutors. The general opinion now, Mr. Holmes, is that the five hanged men were martyrs to the workers' movement. Martyrs for the 8-day workday.
Sherlock Holmes, if what you say is true, Mr. Brock, then the general opinion in the United States is an ass.
Superintendent Moore.
It seems certain, Mr. Holmes, that Illinois' new governor, Mr. Altgeld, is going to pardon the three convicted Haymarket men who were given a 15-year sentence rather than death, Schwab, Fielden, and Neeb. A pardon with full amnesty. As Mr. Brock said, people are now of the opinion that the entire Haymarket trial was a farce, unfair, and that Fisher, Ling, Parsons, Spies, and Engel were unfairly executed.
Sherlock Holmes.
Only four of the guilty men were hanged, sir. Engel, Spies, Parsons, and Fisher.
Ling, the bomb maker, took his own life by biting into a blasting cup that he'd hidden in his cell. It blew his face off. Yet it still took him some hours to die.
Superintendent Brock.
Yet Governor Altgeld and many, many other people are saying now, 7 years later, that these men were heroes of the working class.
Sherlock Holmes, these eight men were murderers and conspirators to murder. I proved this to the satisfaction of the Chicago police and to the courts, not the least by breaking their code in the anarchist paper, the Arbeiter Zeitung, a code which coordinated the making of the bombs, the arming of the anarchists, and their ambush of the police that May Day at Haymarket Square.
Chief Drummond, but no one ever caught the man who was said to have actually thrown the bomb, Schnaubelt.
Sherlock Holmes.
Rudolf Schnaubelt.
Chief Drummond.
Yes, Schnaubelt just disappeared. Vanished. Probably forever.
Sherlock Holmes.
Not forever, Chief Drummond. I found Rudolf Schnaubelt in France 5 years ago this May.
The room again fills with gabble, until Vice President Stevenson raises his hand. When silence descends, the Vice President opens his palm to the Major and Superintendent of the Metropolitan Police Force.
Superintendent Moore.
I heard nothing about Schnaubelt's apprehension.
Sherlock Holmes.
I'm afraid that Mr. Schnaubelt died before he could be taken into proper custody. He threw himself through a glass window and drowned in the fast-running Swiss River below. But not before he admitted to, boasted of, I should say, his part in the conspiracy and his act of throwing the bomb at the police from the Chicago alley opening onto Haymarket Square on May 4th, 1886.
Superintendent Brock.
So, Mr. Holmes, we have only your word of Rudolf Schnaubelt's confession.
Sherlock Holmes.
My word, and the word of two rather extraordinary law enforcement officers who were with me when Schnaubelt made his boasts and then tried to escape.
Chief Drummond.
Can you tell us the names of these men, Mr. Holmes?
Sherlock Holmes.
Certainly. The first fellow detective present was Inspector Lépine, of whom I spoke earlier, and the second police officer there to hear Schnaubelt's confession and to help us pull his dead body from the river was a young and very promising new member of the Brussels police force, an inspector junior grade by the name of Hercule Poirot. But enough of old cases. What are you gentlemen going to do in the next 4 weeks, or less, to save the life of President Grover Cleveland?
Holmes stepped out of the circle and set his back against a bookcase filled with steamboat boiler regulations and specifications. Vice President Stevenson stepped forward and faced the other men in the room.
The President, said Stevenson, has directed that this group, and anyone else we might find it necessary to invite, meet biweekly on this problem of executive protection. I believe Sunday mornings, 10 until noon, shall suffice.
Sundays? Cried Brock. Now I am to give up my Sundays and attending divine services with my family because of this shadow of a phantasm of a threat? Besides, I no longer have any official capacity in law enforcement. There's no reason for me to be here.
The President wished you to be part of this first assembly, Vice President Stevenson said softly.
For what possible reason?
Demanded the haggard former major and superintendent of police.
Your Bureau of Detectives was deeply corrupt when you resigned, said Sherlock Holmes. You left. Many of them remained and are in positions of higher authority today. Detectives on the payroll of the gangs or anarchists could be fatal to our plans. Your expertise in that area is required. In other words, sir, the President of the United States has commanded you to be what I believe American criminals call a rat.
Brock made blustering noises but had nothing discernible to say.
Fine. Let us move on, said Stevenson, as if some minor motion had been passed in the Senate.
Major and Superintendent Moore, please explain to us your department's role in protecting the President. The Major and Superintendent cleared his throat.
The Metropolitan Police provide security for the President when he makes public appearances in Washington City.
Do your officers accompany the President to and from these public venues? Asked Stevenson.
No, Mr. Vice President.
The pale, round face with its faded mustache looked around the room. Who does travel in the city with the President? Silence. Who protects the President when he is in the executive mansion? Asked Stevenson.
The White House Police, said Major and Superintendent Moore.
Is that a unit under your jurisdiction, Major and Superintendent Moore?
Not directly, Mr. Vice President.
Moore again cleared his throat.
We train the recruits and send them to that unit, but the White House Police Force has its own autonomy.
Who is in charge of the White House Police Force? Asked Stevenson.
Sergeant O'Neill, sir,
answered Major and Superintendent Moore.
Sergeant O'Neill?
Yes, sir.
How many police officers are under your supervision in the entire Metropolitan Police Department, Major and Superintendent Moore?
200, Mr. Vice President.
Not counting the White House police?
No, sir.
And how many officers are assigned to the White House police?
There were 3 until this spring, Mr. Vice President, said Major and Superintendent Moore. But the number and intensity of the death threats that President Cleveland has been receiving has caused that unit to raise its numbers to 27.
Working on 3 shifts around the clock, one presumes.
More or less, Mr. Vice President.
So, at any given time, the President has about 9 rookie police officers guarding his life.
Yes, sir,
said Moore, who was beginning to sound aggrieved.
But that is by far the most any American president has had guarding him, with the exception of President Lincoln, who sometimes had an escort of federal cavalry or infantry billeted on the White House grounds.
But not that night at Ford's Theater, said Vice President Stevenson.
No, sir, said Moore. The soldier usually assigned to sit outside the president's booth at the theater was not present that evening.
When President Cleveland goes to Chicago on May 1st to open the Columbian World Exposition in front of a crowd of 100,000 or more people, how many of your Metropolitan Police, or the White House Police, or the Army, for that matter, will accompany the President? Asked Stevenson. There was silence as the men looked at one another. Finally, Major and Superintendent Moore said,
None, Mr. Vice President. When the chief executive travels to other cities, his protection is the responsibility of the police force of that city.
Stevenson looked at Major and Superintendent Moore for a long,
strangely tense moment. Stevenson's gaze remained as soft as his voice, but there was some electrical charge in the air. The vice president turned his gaze toward the tall Secret Service chief.
Mr. Drummond, said Stevenson, I understand that your department has had some experience in recent months in guarding the president.
A small amount, sir, said Drummond.
We have well-trained and armed agents, as you know, and from time to time in the past few weeks, the White House police have asked us to provide some additional protection for President Cleveland.
At the White House, or when he leaves it? Asked the vice president.
When he leaves it, to speak or make any public appearance, sir, said Drummond.
That is the role of the Metropolitan Police Department, sir,
snapped Major and Superintendent Moore. It was obvious that this was the first the major and superintendent was hearing about the Secret Service poaching on the police department's prerogatives.
Drummond nodded. Yes, Major and Superintendent, we know. But during events such as the president's address to the large crowds at City Park last Christmas, your department had only 3 uniformed officers there to guard the president. At the request of the White House police, presumably because of specific threats received, we sent 6 of our armed agents in plain clothes.
Unnecessary, snapped Major and Superintendent Moore.
Ignoring the Metropolitan Police Major and Superintendent, Vice President Stevenson said,
Chief Drummond, has not the Secret Service Department of the Treasury also experimented in accompanying the president during his travels in the city?
Oh, yes,
cried former Major and Superintendent Brock, braying a laugh.
6 men in a carriage rumbling after the president's coach, trying to keep up, getting lost on K Street. What a farce that was! The entire population of Washington, D.C. was amused by the folly.
Drummond bowed his head. Agents following the president's carriage in a separate coach has not proved effective, Mr. Vice President. And President Cleveland and his advisors understandably do not want agents in the presidential coach with them.
Vice President Stevenson folded his arms.
Chief Drummond, if Congress were to assign full-time protective duties to the Secret Service, full-time both here in Washington and wherever and whenever the president travels, how long would it be before your agency could assume those duties?
Drummond blinked.
We would have to hire and train more agents, Mr. Vice President. Currently, we simply do not have enough for full-time protection duties for the president, even here in Washington. And those agents would have to be trained. Bodyguard duties require special skills beyond the usual police officer's purview.
Nonsense, said Moore.
Drummond turned his cold gaze onto the major and superintendent.
Are metropolitan police officers trained to throw themselves in front of the person they are assigned to protect? He asked in a low, firm voice, to take the bullet meant for that official?
Of course not, barked Moore. The very idea is absurd. Police seize the suspect or foil the aim of the would-be assassin before any shot can be fired. They're not trained in suicide.
Effective executive protection agents from the Secret Service will have to be trained in exactly such tactics, Drummond said flatly. Stop the assassin if possible. Take the assassin's bullet in protection of the president if necessary.
Moore turned away to look out the window.
How long, Mr. Drummond? Repeated the vice president.
By the beginning of the new year, Mr. Vice President. For full, round-the-clock, traveling anywhere with the president, executive protection. We shall have to open new bureaus in various American cities, train some agents in the full panoply of advanced security work.
Stevenson nodded almost sadly, as if he had expected that date.
But you can provide some ad hoc protection in the meantime, when called upon?
Yes, sir, said Drummond.
Arrange to have at least 8 of your agents travel with President Cleveland to Chicago in May, said the vice president.
Yes, sir.
If I may make a suggestion, gentlemen, said Sherlock Holmes.
Everyone looked at the consulting detective, who was taking his ease sitting on one corner of the empty desk.
I would suggest, Chief Drummond, that when you choose those agents who will most closely accompany the President, that they can be chosen in part for their height and thickness of torso.
The public won't be able to see the President,
cried former Major and Superintendent Brock.
That is precisely the idea, said Holmes. It is a shame, however, that this tall phalanx of bodyguards cannot surround the President when he is greeting dignitaries or speaking to the crowds. Still, the closer they can press, the safer the President will be.
Drummond nodded and made a note.
We have such large and tall men amongst our best agents, he said softly. I shall see that they shall be closest to the President when he is walking somewhere or standing alone.
Preposterous! Said former Major and Superintendent Brock.
Ignoring Brock and nodding slightly to Holmes, Vice President Adlai E. Stevenson said, And so we shall continue having meetings here on Sunday, gentlemen, until the details of this transfer of executive protection responsibilities are worked out. Again, he glanced at Holmes and then at Brock and Washington's current police Major and Superintendent Moore.
Although not everyone here today may be required in all future meetings.
What shall we call this committee, sir?
Asked Rockhill from the State Department. Stevenson smiled slightly.
Since it is the office of Steamboat Inspection Department's Supervising Inspector General Dismont, I suggest we refer to our little group as the Steamboat Inspection Committee. Any objections?
No one spoke. Before the men began moving toward the doorway, Vice President Stevenson said,
A final question, gentlemen. Who is in charge of liaison with the Chicago police for the President's security at the Columbian Exposition on May 1st?
The silence was embarrassing.
I can do that, sir, Drummond said at last.
I shall as well, said Major and Superintendent Moore. I had always intended to send a telegram or two.
Sherlock Holmes moved away from where he lounged against the bookcase.
I shall be going to Chicago next week to make arrangements, he said while tugging his kid gloves tighter.
I would be pleased to work with Chief Drummond and his Secret Service on such liaison with the Chicago PD.
The six men took turns riding the lift down in pairs. Holmes rode down with the Vice President. At the bottom, the two men had to take care in stepping up the 7 inches the heavy elevator had sunk below the level of the first floor. The Supervising Inspector General of Steamboat Inspection and his secretary were standing in the lobby, their faces red with indignation.
Thank you, Mr. Dismont, said the Vice President to the flustered Steamboat Inspector General. I will be in touch regarding any future weekend needs for your office.
This is ridiculous,
muttered Dismont as he and his secretary jumped the 7 inches down into the elevator to ride back up to their offices, and while Holmes held the front door for the Vice President. Outside on the sidewalk, Stevenson turned to the detective.
Is it, Mr. Holmes?
Is what, sir?
Is our whole effort? No, is this entire talk of attempted assassination by anarchists? Ridiculous. Are we all being ridiculous?
We'll know soon enough, Mr. Vice President.
Holmes touched the handle of his walking stick to the brim of his top hat and turned away up Constitution Avenue. 3. Tombstones for Teeth and Tame Cats. On Saturday morning, Henry James received a hand-delivered message from John Hay, asking if James could drop by that afternoon, any time that afternoon, for a talk that would take no more than a few minutes. James did stop by the mansion commanding the corner of H and 16th Streets, taking care to time his stop late enough after lunch and early enough before tea time, so as not to put Hay to any obligation. James had barely given his coat and hat and cane to Benson, when Hay hurried from his study to shake James's hand, thank him for coming, and lead him into the parlor.
I've always admired the two kinds of stone you and Clara chose for this room, said James, settling into the deep leather chair to which Hay had gestured.
Do you?
Asked Hay, looking around idly as if he'd not looked at the stone or the parlor for some time.
The African marble is called Aurora Pompadour, I seem to recall, and the rest is Mexican onyx.
My favorite combination of stone in your lovely home may be the yellow fireplace in the library with its reddish or pink hearth, said James.
Oh, yes. That hearthstone was damnable hard to find. Everything was either too red or too pink or too something. As it was, we decided on that very subdued reddish porphyry. Boisé d'Orient, I think they called it. Would you care for something to drink, Harry?
No, thank you. This is a restful pause in the middle of my constitutional. Walking allows my mind to wander back to work. I've been pondering a new play, but nothing clear enough to talk about yet.
James had hurried that last phrase in to make sure they would not be discussing his work.
Then I'm doubly sorry for intruding on your Saturday afternoon, said Hay. But I thought a fair warning was due to you.
Warning?
And an apology, said Hay. You and Mr. Holmes should be receiving an invitation to a tiny dinner party for tomorrow evening. Nothing elaborate, just Adams and a few friends here at the old fort. Half the sincere apology is for such short notice.
And the second half?
Murmured James.
You asked for discretion when you arrived. Your presence not to be advertised, that is. But that was almost 2 weeks ago, Harry. You know how word gets around in this small town, in spite of all our efforts.
Of course, said James, and I am delighted to hear that Adams is back, and I look forward to seeing him.
He says that he never dines out, Hay said, still seeming somewhat distracted. But you know as well as I that that's all hogwash. Henry has fewer full-fledged dinner parties next door, but he's as social as ever. He simply wants to appear the recluse.
I possess some kindred feeling there, said James. May I ask who else will be attending besides Adams? King's not back in town, is he?
Not that I'm aware of, said Hay. I sent a cable to his union club in New York, but haven't received a reply. He's probably a mile underground in Mexico by now, up to his earlobes in gold nuggets or diamonds.
James waited.
The rest of the party will be made up of the usual suspects, continued Hay.
James remembered all too well going to a mediocre play, little more than a comic romance melodrama, really, in London with the Hays, and how for days afterward John had kept repeating that, to James, eminently forgettable line.
The party will be made up of all the usual suspects.
Knowing the rather tight Washington social circles the Adamses, Hays, et al. Had always moved within, James caught at least a glimmer of the humor Hays found in all the usual suspects.
Don and Lizzie are coming, said Hay. And Lodge and Nanny, of course. And Adams. The whole thing is a sort of welcome home thing for Adams. And, oh, yes, when you inquired about the children last week, I told you that Alice, Helen, Clarence, and Dell were all away at school. But Dell has the weekend off from St. Paul's Academy, and Helen will also be joining us.
Wonderful, said James, who loathed having children, even nearly grown children, at a dinner party. It's been far too long since I've seen them. You said in a recent letter that Dell has had quite the growth spurt.
17-year-old Adelbert Dell Hay had always struck Henry James, and probably his father John Hay as well, as a rather slow, dull, uninteresting boy. But James hadn't seen any of the four children since the Hay family's last en masse descent upon London at least 5 years ago.
Amazing growth spurt, laughed Hay. Dell's over 6 feet tall now and weighs more than 200 pounds, and he's become quite the athlete at St. Paul's. He's going to Yale in the autumn and plans to go out for football. Football, Harry. American football, where one rarely uses one's feet.
Football? James said blankly.
The name, in an American context, rang only the faintest of bells. But not what we call soccer?
No, an entirely new game, said Hay. Evidently it was invented, or rather adapted, from European football and rugby. Mostly rugby, I think. And its rules laid down a dozen or so years ago by a Yale undergraduate at the time, a certain Walter Camp, who became general athletic director and head football coach, whatever that means. Football is all the rage at Ivy League colleges now, Harry. It seems that Harvard and Yale have been in a deadly annual football competition for some years. Last year, a Harvard chess master named Lauren Deland introduced a devastating new play or maneuver or move or something called the flying wedge. No clue as to what that means. But Yale still managed to win 6-0. Dell can't wait to play under Walter Camp's tutelage.
And Helen will also be here tomorrow night, said James.
He would have stabbed himself in both eyes with a dull knife if that is what it would have taken to get off the subject of sports.
She must be 18?
Yes, said Hay, and she's very dedicated these days to writing poetry and even some short fiction. Don't let her corner you, Harry.
In London last, she was a lovely and invigorating interlocutor at age 13, said James. I can only imagine how pleasant it would be now to be cornered by her to pursue the discussion of all things literary.
Adams needs to meet Sherlock Holmes, said Hay, his voice suddenly serious. That's the primary reason for this gathering. Not that Adams wouldn't have arranged to see you at the earliest possible opportunity, Harry. He was distraught at having missed your first week here, but I wasn't sure what to tell him about the whole Holmes thing. Do you think it will be Sherlock Holmes or Jan Sigerson who will appear tomorrow night?
To whom did you address the invitation? Asked James.
To Mr. Holmes.
Then I wager that it will be Mr. Holmes who appears.
Oh, I almost forgot, said Hay as he walked James through the foyer to the door. We've also invited, as Adams and Wendell always call him, the boy.
The boy? Mused James.
Oh, you mean...
Oh, oh my. Oh dear. I keep forgetting that he's in Washington these days.
I made him promise to be on his best behavior, said Hay.
James's smile was three parts irony to two parts anticipation.
We shall see. We shall see.
Sherlock Holmes had been invited as Mr. Sherlock Holmes to the 8 p.m. Hayes Sunday dinner gathering, so he arrived as Mr. Sherlock Holmes. His second and third steamer trunks had caught up to him via the British Embassy in Washington, so he wore the latest London fashion in white tie and black tails, soft pumps so highly polished that they could be used as a signaling mirror in an emergency, but not the overly flexible Capizio black jazz Oxford so popular with the younger set for a long night of dancing. A crimson-lined black cape, the silkiest of silk, 6.5-inch tall top hat, a formal vest with lapels and scooped front, a brilliantly white formal shirt with a stand-up rather than wing collar, and, since it was a dinner, not a ball, no white gloves. The other men were dressed similarly. No sign of the less formal, and to Holmes definitely déclassé, new tuxedo jacket, and upon their introduction by Hay, Holmes had to award Henry Adams the laurels for oldest, most worn, and by far most beautiful jacket of the evening, although Henry Cabot Lodge's shining new threads must have cost 5 times the price of Adams's time-worn perfection. The only man there that night who did not look to have been born into his clothes was Hay's heavily muscled and bull-necked teenaged son, Dell, who seemed to be bursting out of his formal wear even as they all watched. The ladies, with only a few missed cues, were also upholding the highest standards of modern French-American design. The group had only a few minutes for introductions and polite conversation before they were called into the dining room. Holmes had to admit to a feeling of admiration. He dined with the Prince of Wales, the King of Scandinavia, and more elite and sophisticated hosts in England, France, and around the world, but he couldn't remember a more beautiful room, chandelier, or table. Realizing that this dining room might comfortably seat 50 at a State Department banquet, Holmes marveled at how Clara Hay had arranged it to perfection for the 12 of them, 4 women and 8 men. The dinner was lopsided in terms of gender, but Clara and John Hay had made up for that in careful placement of their guests and beautiful but low centerpieces that hid no one's face from anyone else. After they found their seats, there seemed to be a white tie and tails servant behind every chair to help them with the extreme effort of scooting in or scooting out. Holmes took a minute to appreciate the seating arrangements. At the head of the table was not John Hay, as one would expect in the man's own home, but Henry Adams. The placement emphasized the welcome home Henry aspect of the dinner, but Holmes also suspected that the chair provided to Adams had a little higher seat, a little extra cushion, and thus put the short, bald man at eye height with everyone else. Down the right side of the table, Holmes's side, was first the newly sworn-in Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, perfectly groomed down to his perfectly cropped beard and mustache, but cold of eye. Very cold of eye. Then the stolid but animated Clara Hay, whose gown of royal blue silk blended with satin and a design of garnet-colored peacock feathers, with sleeves and trim of garnet-colored silk, satin, and velvet, would have been absolutely breathtakingly original if it hadn't been featured in that March's issue of Harper's Bazaar. And then Pennsylvania Senator James Donald Cameron, whose dark eyes seemed as sadly drooping as his thick mustache, then Sherlock, who found himself sitting directly across the table from Henry James, and who knew at once that this was no accident, since at mid-table both of them could then field questions from both ends of the table, and to Sherlock's left, young Dell Hay, smiling and ham-fisted but obviously comfortable with formal dining in such elite company as Henry Adams, Senator J. Donald Cameron, author Henry James, and the ice-eyed congressman billionaire only this month turned U.S. Senator, Henry Cabot Lodge. At the end of the table to Holmes's left was seated the other special guest of the evening, Civil Service Commissioner Theodore Roosevelt. Other than hearing from Henry James that Adams and Hay and Clarence King and the late Clover Adams had sometimes referred to young Roosevelt, whom they'd known for many years, as the boy, Holmes knew little about the man. But Holmes was interested in what he saw. Merely in the act of helping young Helen Julia Hay, to his left, into her seat, and then taking his own chair and beaming down both sides of the table, Theodore Roosevelt radiated aggression. With small eyes squinting out from behind pince-nez, a military-trimmed mustache, and rows of teeth that seemed strangely aligned top and bottom, a horse's teeth, a fierce stallion's pre-breeding grimace, and a powerful, coiled, compact body that made athlete Dell Hay's tall form seem to shrink by comparison. The grinning Theodore Roosevelt seemed prepared to attack everyone at the table. Or eat them whole, thought Holmes. John Hay's 18-year-old daughter, Helen Julia, sitting to the Roosevelt creature's left, was, to Holmes's always objective eye for such things, one of those rare, beautiful female creatures who actually lived up to the image of the new Gibson girl. Long, white neck, her hair swept back close to that perfect head until it rolled most naturally into a gay Gibson girl puff, her soft chiffon dress emphasizing the modern ideal of a woman as tall and slender, yet with ample bosom and hips, all while giving off a sense of high intelligence mixed with an athlete's glow. Then, across the table from Holmes, was Henry James, his balding dome seeming to give off an extra beneficial glow in the candlelight. Holmes could see in an instant that James was in his native element, even at an extraordinary table such as this, at which sat two senators, a man who was a grandson and great-grandson of presidents of the United States, several of the wealthiest men in America, no fewer than 4 famous historians,
three of the most beautiful women Holmes had seen in years, and an energetic young cannibal flashing his tombstone-sized teeth. The Hays obviously had given James the gift of beauty on either side, Helen Julia Hay to his right, and Nanny Lodge to his left. Nanny Lodge, sitting between Henry James and John Hay, was lovely in the usual Gilded Age ways. Slim, fair, wasp-waisted, with lovely hands and a sweet disposition. But the most outstanding aspect of the 43-year-old's aging beauty were her eyes. Eyes which Holmes's friend Watson would have immediately described as bewitching, and which Margaret Chandler described in writing as the color of the sky when stars begin to twinkle. No such poetic phrases entered Holmes's mind on Sunday, April 2nd, 1893, as he paused a second to study those eyes. Nanny was turned to her left toward John Hay and was not aware of the detective's brief but intense appraisal, so he filed away the odd, soft intensity of Mrs. Cabot Lodge's eye color and was reminded of it years later only when his new friend, the painter John Singer Sargent, lamented never having had the chance to paint Nanny Lodge, saying, "I had such an unqualified regard for her that the odds were in favor of my succeeding in getting something of that kindness and intelligence of her expression and the unforgettable blue of her eyes." Perhaps. Beyond Nanny Lodge and the smiling, laughing John Hay, at the corner of the table near Mr. Adams, was the true beauty at the table. Lizzie Cameron. The doleful-looking Senator Cameron's wife was, according to Henry James's whisper as they talked to the Hayes home that evening, the loveliest and most sought-after woman in all of Washington society. In his cool, distant way, Sherlock Holmes saw why at once. Lizzie Cameron's dress was simultaneously the simplest and most daring of any of the perfectly dressed women's at the table. Her shoulders were bare and white. Her arms were long, perfectly white, and ended in long-fingered hands that looked as though they'd been designed by God to caress men's faces and hair. She had a long neck unadorned by jewelry or cloth bands and a sharply oval face. Lizzie's hair this night was gathered up on both sides and rose in a bun in the back, but looked impossibly natural. She did not smile much, Holmes had already noted, and yet with those arching brows, deep, dark eyes, and perfectly shaped mouth, Elizabeth Sherman Cameron was that rarest object of her sex, a woman whose entire beauty could shine through when she was not smiling, or even when she looked actively severe. In the few minutes they'd been seated, Holmes had seen enough of the almost imperceptible glances, nearly invisible reactions, to tell him that Henry Adams, at age 55, some 22 years older than Lizzie Cameron, was in love with her. That their host, John Hay, without ever looking directly at his table partner to the left, said, with his entire body's balance and tension, that he was madly in love with Lizzie Cameron. Henry James, Holmes could see and would have predicted, admired Lizzie's beauty the way a cat might admire a bowl of milk it had no intention of sipping from. Henry Cabot Lodge took his wife's friend's beauty as a given of their station in life. Young Dell Hay had known Lizzie Cameron for most of his life and was obviously looking at her as one of his parents' friends, and Theodore Roosevelt bestowed his giant, menacing grin upon her with a happily married man's innocent benevolence. Senator James Don Cameron, who would be 60 in 2 months, looked as miserable as if he'd been actively cuckolded by all the scores and hundreds of men who had dreamt of achieving that blissful goal with the beautiful Lizzie Cameron. Holmes felt, knew, that Lizzie Cameron teased, teased, tempted, and teased, but did not actually bestow her favors. Not on poor Adams, who, Holmes would soon learn, had rushed 10,000 miles around the world from the South Seas to come to Lizzie's beckoning telegram from Paris, only to be shunned by her once he'd arrived. Not on poor John Hay, who, Holmes sensed at once, had yet to declare his physical love for the lady, but who, after his inevitable rebuff, would join Henry Adams and a mist-shrouded legion of gray others who had been relegated to the role of tame cat in Lizzie Cameron's life. And Holmes also felt, knew, that Lizzie Cameron was a dangerous and treacherous person. Certainly, Holmes exempting himself, and since neither Professor Moriarty nor Lucan Adler appeared to be present this evening, the most dangerous and treacherous person in the room. The oysters arrived, and the dinner officially began. 4. A shocking shortage of canvasbacks. While guests had been milling prior to this dinner, Henry James had stepped into the kitchen to say hello to Hay's chef for this meal, a man named Charles Ranhofer, who had served for a while as the personal chef for William Waldorf Astor, the richest man in America until he moved to England in 1891. Chef Ranhofer was preparing to publish a cookbook, which ran to more than 1,000 pages, called The Epicurean. It would sell more copies worldwide than any novel Henry James ever published. James had first met Ranhofer when he was a guest at Lansdowne House, Astor's rented London mansion, and often heard of the chef's reputation at Delmonico's restaurant on Fifth Avenue. This evening, the famous chef was too busy filling Hayes' oversized kitchen and extended staff with commands, orders, and ultimatums to pause to chat, so James simply wished him well, but not before he caught a glimpse of Charles's menu for the evening. Menu: huître en coquille, Rudesheimer. Potage tortue verte, amontillado. Caviar sur canapé médoc. Homard à la Maryland, Royal Charter. Riz de veau aux champignons, sel de mouton, pommes parisiennes, haricots verts, suprême de volaille, pâté de foie gras, Bellevue, sorbet à la romaine, cigarettes, teal duck, celery mayonnaise, Clos de Vougeot, fromage, Duc port wine, glacé à la napolitaine, Château Lafite, Old Reserve Madeira. The cigarettes had been crossed out, which James wholly approved of, especially in mixed company, but also because it had become déclassé in most upper-class English and continental meals to include smoking as a formal menu item. The oysters were followed by soup, a light dish which James paid little attention to because of the conversation with the beautiful women on each side of him. Then, a fish course. The first 10 minutes of conversation were mostly taken up by questions, almost exclusively from the ladies at the table, to Sherlock Holmes. Was he really a consulting detective? What did a consulting detective do? Were his adventures as exciting as they read in The Strand and Harper's Weekly?
I can't answer that last question, I fear, said Holmes in his clipped, formal, but friendly English accent. It's only been the last year or two that these so-called chronicles of my cases have been published by Dr. Watson, and I honestly haven't had the time or opportunity to read any of them.
But they're based on truth? Asked Helen Julia Hay.
Quite possibly, said Holmes. But my friend Dr. Watson and his editor and agent, Mr. Doyle, are pledged to entertain the reader. And in my experience, the hard truth and entertainment rarely coexist peacefully.
But what about Silver Blaze?
Asked Clara, her voice small but determined.
That case was true, was it not?
Who or what is Silver Blaze? Asked Holmes.
Clara grew a little flustered but managed.
The case, the name of the racehorse that was stolen, that ran away? The story in last month's Harper's Weekly.
I confess that I've never heard of an English racehorse named Silver Blaze, Mrs. Hay, said Holmes. You see, Clara, said John Hay, I told you it was fiction. I lose a fortune at the track when I'm in England, and I'd never heard of a colt named Silver Blaze either.
Holmes smiled at that.
I did have a minor case involving a horse named Seabreeze in 1888. He won the Oaks and St. Ledger in that year, but his
disappearance amounted to little more than his wandering away one night. The neighboring farmer found him, and I worked to the limits of my detecting ability to follow clear hoof prints in the mud to the neighboring farmer's home.
The group chuckled, but Clara persisted.
So the trainer wasn't found dead? She asked.
He was, actually, said Holmes, but it was a mere accident. The poor lad was taking Seabreeze for his evening walk, evidently had noticed some possible problem with the colt's right rear hoof, had knelt behind the filly, never a good idea at the best of times, and lit a match in the failing light even before raising the hoof for inspection. Seabreeze kicked once, purely out of instinct, and the poor fellow's head was...
Holmes glanced around the shining table at the shining faces.
That is, he died instantly of a head injury. But no foul play.
Silver Blaze was a colt in the story anyway, said Clara Hay. Not a filly.
Everyone laughed with her. Guided by both Hayes and Henry Adams's hosting expertise, the attention soon moved away from Holmes, and localized conversations quickly began to include entire ends of the table and then everyone. 12 diners was close to the perfect number for intimate and audible table conversation, especially with such reticent conversationalists in the group as Henry Cabot Lodge, Don Cameron, and smiling, attentive, polite, but mostly quiet, Del Hay. James was reminded that Adams and Hay, and the late Clover, were neither too educated nor too proud to pun.
Our poor Vito Pom-Pom came home with an injured eye today, said Nanny Lodge, speaking loudly to be heard by Helen Julia Hay on the other side of James, so that everyone at the table heard her. There was no lag in response.
How dreadful, said Henry Adams. Now, I forget, Nanny, is Vito Pom-Pom one of the servants or a relative?
Henry, sighed Mrs. Lodge. You know perfectly well that Vito Pom-Pom is our beloved Pomeranian.
Your beloved Pomeranian, my dear,
murmured Henry Cabot Lodge in disapproving bass tones that caused the crystal chandelier to tremble.
How strange, said John Hay, and I thought the new immigration acts had all but shut off the flow of Pomeranian refugees into this country. Tragic, tragic.
Nanny Lodge frowned prettily at Hay sitting on her left.
My diagnosis is that Vito Pom-Pom is most likely suffering from a cataract, said Henry Adams.
Most likely a Tom cataract, added Hay.
Those who allowed themselves to chuckle at such things, a group which certainly did not include Senator Lodge nor Senator Cameron, and to which Del Hay wasn't sure to join or not, chuckled.
It could have been much worse, Henry James said softly. Our friend Vito might have been completely curtailed.
There was the briefest of pauses, and then more chuckles. Lizzie Cameron laughed out loud, a fresh, gay, unself-conscious laugh. Then, with the happy irrelevance of youth, Helen Julia Hay said to the table at large,
Is everyone looking forward to going to the Chicago World's Fair this summer? I know I am. Everything I've read about the White City says it's perfectly marvelous.
It's not precisely a World's Fair, my dear, said her father. Chicago is hosting the World's Columbian Exposition, commemorating the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America.
But the exposition is opening in 1893, said Dell.
Henry James opened his palms.
Columbus missed finding America by, what, some 2,000 miles between here and Trinidad?
2,173 miles from where we sit right now, said Henry Adams.
So Columbus missed discovering America by 2,173 miles, continued James. The exposition missed the anniversary of this non-discovery by only 1 year. Our aim is improving.
Hay turned to Adams.
You're sure about that extra 173 miles?
Quite certain,
said Adams with a small, mischievous, and rather charming smile.
Did you know that when Columbus landed on Trinidad, the island was occupied by both Carib and Arawak-speaking groups?
Said Helen, her tone not one of satisfaction at knowing such trivia, but rather of anticipation.
What does one call a resident of Trinidad?
Asked Lizzie Cameron.
A Trinidadian?
She'd used the short vowel sound for the A.
Dadians, for short, said John Hay. Miss Hay was correct about the natives speaking only Carib and Arawak, said Theodore Roosevelt, his voice seeming to boom even when he spoke in low tones. But that was only after the Pomeranian invasion of the island in 1439 A.D.
They were on their fourth of nine wines to go with this dinner, and the laughter was flowing more easily now.
Vito Pom-Pom understands only Arawak, said Nanny Lodge. How distressing.
Probably why that little hairball of a rat dog can't learn the simplest of commands, grunted Senator Henry Cabot Lodge.
Nanny wiggled her lacquered fingertips at her husband.
But I don't want to miss the fair and the White City and Mr. Ferris's wheel and Mr. Cody's Wild West show and everything,
cried Helen Julia Hay in a voice that suddenly sounded 10 years younger than her 18 years.
There's no reason you should have to, said Senator Don Cameron. None of us is leaving for Europe until July. The exposition opens on May 1st. Sometime in May, I'll lay on a few private railroad cars and we'll all go together for a few days. Are you game, Adams?
Henry Adams grumbled, but looked at Lizzie Cameron and then nodded his assent.
Hey?
Absolutely. We're with you, Don.
Mr. Holmes, will you join us?
Asked Cameron.
We'll park the cars right at the entrance to the fair, and there will be sleeping rooms for everyone.
Thank you for the invitation, said Holmes with a nod. I may have to be at the exposition earlier than that. We shall see.
Helen Julia Hay didn't actually clap her hands, but she folded them like a little girl preparing to pray. Her smile, thought James, truly earned that tired descriptor of radiant. In a departure from usual dining protocol, the remove, what Henry James knew as the releve, this evening a saddle of mutton sliced very thin and set on a warm plate with a little gravy, was carved in the dining room by Chef Ranhofer and served between the two entrees. Servants glided in and refilled everyone's champagne glass.
I say, said Senator Don Cameron. This is smashing good champagne. I seem to recognize it, and then I don't. What is it, John?
Royal Charter, said Hay. I thought only Delmonico's was allowed to lay in Royal Charter, boomed Roosevelt.
It is, said Hay. It does.
Well, I'd rather spend the whole summer at the Chicago Exposition than in boring old Europe, boring old Switzerland, said Helen. I believe we'll be in Zermatt and Lucerne this summer with the Camerons and the Lodges and Mr. Adams for only a few weeks, said Clara Hay. The July and August months of the fair will just have to get along without us.
Best thing, said Adams. I went to the Bicentennial in 76, and other than the warning that the telephone was about to invade our homes, the whole affair was overblown and useless. More boring than Switzerland, Helen.
Except for the part where they scalped Custer, said John Hay. That was entertaining.
John,
said Clara. Hay folded his hands meekly in his lap and looked chastened.
Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show will be at the Chicago Exposition, said Roosevelt. I hear that they may reenact the Custer debacle, with Sitting Bull acting his part. Sounds like great fun.
Wasn't Crazy Horse with Sitting Bull when they ambushed Custer?
Asked Dell.
Yes, yes,
boomed Roosevelt, turning his entire upper body so that everyone could be the recipient of his grin.
But we killed Crazy Horse in 77.
You have a history of the Wild West coming out soon, don't you, Mr. Roosevelt?
Said Lizzie Cameron. Roosevelt nodded, but also ducked his massive head almost shyly.
I do. It's called
The Winning of the West, and volumes 1 and 2 should be published this summer. But even though I've spent years working on it, I hesitate to mention my scribbling in the company of the great historians at this table.
It was true, thought James. Henry Adams was perhaps the most honored living American historian, and his volumes on the Jefferson administrations were masterpieces of their kind. John Hay's book about his former boss, Abraham Lincoln, written in collaboration with his old friend John Nicolay, had sold well in both America and Europe and was considered the reference book on Lincoln's presidency. Henry Cabot Lodge's ancestors had not only known George Washington on a first-name basis, but Lodge had just finished a magisterial history of Washington. Young Roosevelt, although obviously a dynamo of energy and intellectual accomplishment, had much to be modest about in this evening's company of fellow historians. Or in politics, for that matter, thought James. Suddenly, Don Cameron piped up, and his voice was surprisingly strong. James had almost forgotten that the husband with the doleful countenance was also a U.S. senator.
You have nothing to fear from me, Commissioner Roosevelt. I've not written a history of anything or anybody, nor shall I. I prefer to read histories and biographies in the quiet of my study.
But you have so much you could write about, Don, said John Hay. You were Secretary of War under President Grant during the Great Sioux Wars, yes?
Cameron nodded.
It's an interesting age we live in, said Adams. Or at least it seems like only a few years to an ancient such as myself. We've gone from watching the Indians wipe out Custer's entire troop and terrorizing the Western territories to paying to watch Sitting Bull play-acting himself in Mr. Cody's Wild West show. A massacre with no blood. A battle with no death.
Mr. Roosevelt, said Nanny Lodge, you have a ranch out west somewhere, or you did have one. Have you ever had to shoot at an Indian?
James looked carefully at the young man. He knew that Roosevelt had bought and moved to that ranch when his beloved first wife, Alice, had died in February of 1884, just after giving birth to a daughter. As with Adams and Clover, Roosevelt had never mentioned his wife Alice again in public. Shortly after her death, Roosevelt had left his new daughter, named Alice, to be raised by his sister while he moved out to the Badlands of Dakota Territory to begin life anew as a rancher and cowboy. Roosevelt gave Nanny an even larger grin than he'd shown so far, something Henry James would have not thought possible.
Mrs. Lodge, I've shot at Indians, white desperados, drunken Mexicans, sober Mexicans, grizzly bears, wolves, scorpions, rattlesnakes, and 100 more varieties of God's most miserable creatures. And I tend to hit what I shoot at.
Do you think Indians are among God's more miserable creatures, Mr. Roosevelt?
Asked Lizzie Cameron. The bright candlelight reflected from the chandelier's crystal prisms made Roosevelt's pince-nez gleam like 2 round beacons of light as he turned his gaze toward Lizzie.
As your husband knew well when he was Secretary of War, Mrs. Cameron, said Roosevelt, his grin never quite disappearing, the most ultimately righteous of all wars is a war with savages, though it's true that such a war is apt to be also the most terrible and inhuman. The rude, fierce settlers who drove the savages from our western lands with Remington rifles and Bowie knives have laid all of civilized mankind under a debt to them.
So you think there's no place for the various Indian nations in our national future?
Asked John Hay, his voice soft but intense.
American and Indian, Boer and Zulu, Cossack and Tartar, New Zealander and Maori, barked Roosevelt. In each case, the white victor, horrible though many of his deeds had to be, has laid deep the foundations for the future greatness of a mighty people. It is of incalculable importance that America, Australia, and Siberia should pass out of the hands of their red, black, and yellow Aboriginal owners and become the heritage of the dominant world races.
Chef Ranhofer had wheeled in his pièce de résistance for the evening. a rich and elaborate meat pie made from sliced goose liver tureen and cooked truffles that were glazed in aspic and arranged in layers in a raised pastry shell that had been baked in an intricate mold in the shape of a nautilus. And now the servants were cutting the pie and setting the warmed plates in place. But no one but Roosevelt began eating, even after everyone was served, and an obviously piqued chef had retired to the kitchen. Everyone was waiting for Roosevelt's next words. Between large and voracious bites, he continued.
You see,
he said, glancing up from the steaming goose liver pie to Lizzie Cameron.
As my modest volumes of The Winning of the West will show in detail, hard-earned white supremacy over the savages and savage lands of this continent has given birth to a new race of mankind, the American race.
Henry Adams cleared his throat.
My British publisher has sent me an advance manuscript copy of Charles H. Pearson's new book. I believe it will be published early next year, titled National Life and Character. Oh, have you heard of Mr. Pearson by any chance, Mr. Holmes? Or met him, perhaps?
Yes, I've heard of him, said Holmes. I've not met him. I believe he only recently retired from Parliament.
Quite so, said Adams.
He was fumbling in his jacket and waistcoat pockets.
I'd copied down one of his, for possible reviewing purposes, oh, here it is.
He removed a folded piece of paper, flattened it next to his untouched but still steaming meat pie, leaned forward so the intense candlelight from the chandelier glowed on his bald pate, and said,
Mr. Pearson's fear for the coming new century, and for the near future here and in Europe as well, was put this way.
Adams' reading voice was smooth and assured.
The day will come, and perhaps is not far distant, when the European observer will look round to see the globe girdled with a continuous zone of the black and yellow races, no longer too weak for aggression or under tutelage, but independent, or practically so, in government, monopolizing the trade of their own regions and circumscribing the industry of the Europeans. When Chinamen and the natives of Hindostan, the states of Central and South America, by that time predominantly Indian, are represented by fleets in the European seas, invited to international conferences, and welcomed as allies in quarrels of the civilized world. The citizens of these countries will then be taken up into the social relations of the white races, will throng the English turf or the salons of Paris, and will be admitted to intermarriage. It is idle to say that if all this should come to pass, our pride of place will not be humiliated. We shall wake to find ourselves elbowed and hustled, and perhaps even thrust aside by peoples whom we looked down upon as servile and thought of as bound always to minister to our needs. The solitary consolation will be that the changes have been inevitable.
Adams folded up the paper and his tiny spectacles, and looked down the length of the table to see young Theodore Roosevelt still grinning at him.
You don't agree, Mr. Roosevelt? Asked Adams.
Pearson's speaking primarily about the black and yellow races, said Roosevelt. By the time they will have the capability of threatening us militarily or in trade, the descendants of the Negro and today's Chinaman may be as intellectual as the Athenian. The American race, and the English as well, of course, shall simply then be dealing with another civilized nation of non-Aryan blood, precisely as we now deal with Magyar, Finn, and Basque. This is as it should be, since white Europeans and Americans were never designed by their creator to live and propagate permanently in the hot regions of Africa, South America, and India. It's only here on our continent, and the white Russians on theirs, the white Australians on theirs, that we must essentially eliminate savages and their cultures, so that the American race shall rule in its own home.
Perhaps you'd like to review Mr. Pearson's book, said Adams.
I would,
said Roosevelt, with an even broader grin.
I'll ask his publisher to send you an advance copy.
In the meantime, I heartily recommend the pie, said Clara Hay. The truffles are especially tasty, and I hope that everyone had a chance to notice their artful arrangement by Chef Ranhofer. And after the pie, we shall have some sorbet
and then the teal duck, I believe.
Teal? Said Henry Cabot Lodge. Not canvasback?
Evidently, canvasback are all but impossible to procure these days, said John Hay, possibly due to lack of their favored wild celery or the disappearance of their wetlands, or some say due to overhunting.
It's most likely a deliberate shortage, said Henry Adams. A ploy to raise the price of canvasback in the restaurants and butcher shops. Did you know that almost two-thirds of the decent restaurants in New York are owned, directly or indirectly, by Jews?
No one paused in their eating save for Del Hay, who said, Really?
It's the truth, said Adams. Creating a canvasback shortage to drive up the price of the duck is precisely what those people, the Jews, are so clever at doing.
There was another moment of silence.
Well,
said Henry Cabot Lodge, turning to his left to look at the obviously distraught Clara Hay.
Teal is every bit as tasty as canvasback, and I don't believe anything could surpass tonight's pâté de foie gras Bellevue, that amazing goose liver terrine. My compliments not only to the chef, but to our lovely hostess.
Clara smiled and blushed. Servants cleared glasses of Seinberger Cabernet that had accompanied the foie gras and filled everyone's new and larger glasses with Clos de Vougeot. The conversation at the table moved on. It was almost 2.5 hours since dinner had commenced, and if everything simply ended now, if everyone had gone home immediately after the fromage course, several lives would have had different futures. But the glacé à la Napolitaine had revived sagging spirits, and the closing wines of the evening, before brandy in the library for the men, of course, the Chateau Lafitte and Old Reserve Madeira, were especially fine, although Del Hay looked as if he had drunk enough wine for the evening as early as the Duke Port with the fromage, or even the Clos de Vougeot that had come with the teal pie. The eighth and ninth wines of the evening made Del grow quiet, perhaps even a little morose, but it loosened the already glib tongues of the majority of the people at the table. Only Sherlock Holmes and Senator Cameron were saying almost nothing. Henry Cabot Lodge had told a funny story with the fromage and was still in a talkative mood. Suddenly, Helen raised her wine glass.
We've toasted other things, but we haven't toasted Uncle Harry returning to the United States.
Hear, hear, cried John Hay, and everyone drank to Henry James's return.
I hope and trust that Mr. James will be staying in America this time, said Theodore Roosevelt.
The younger man's eyes were bright, but James had noticed all through the meal how very little wine the civil service commissioner had drunk. James smiled his appreciation at the comment, but said,
Alas, I must soon return to my modest little flat in London at De Vere Gardens. I scribble for a living, and ever more rarely can find time to enjoy delightful nights out such as tonight. A true delight, Clara. John?
Clara Hay flushed pink and smiled, and her husband nodded.
No, I mean it, said Roosevelt. This new American race needs its writers. America needs its expatriate writers to come home and to write about America. Don't you agree, Mr. Holmes?
Holmes, who had been listening in silence for so long, showing no reaction other than a polite smile, merely nodded recognition of Roosevelt's misplaced question. Perhaps Roosevelt hadn't noticed that he was English.
But Uncle Harry does write about Americans, protested Helen.
So much so that my publishers and literary agent all but despair, said James with a smile.
Did you read The Portrait of a Lady?
Helen asked Roosevelt.
It is an amazing word portrait of an American woman.
And published more than a decade ago, about the last time Mr. James was here in the United States, said Roosevelt. I say again, America needs its writers to come home from Europe or other decadent and comfortable hiding places, and to relearn America and its people.
Hay leaned forward as if to intervene, but James, smiling, said,
I would wager, Mr. Roosevelt, that you did not write every word of The Winning of the West while you were in the West. Your notes and memories and research certainly prepared you to continue writing that valuable tome when you were in New York or Washington, or I would assume even aboard a steamship bound for somewhere far away.
Of course, said Roosevelt,
and pumped his fist in an odd gesture for dismissal.
But I had lived in the West, hunted game in the West, tracked and captured bad men, and faced down murderous Indians in the West. I was in the West and of the West before I began writing the first page of my book about the West.
And I was in America and of America for many years before I went to Europe to write about many topics, but often about Americans encountering Europe, James said softly.
But you left 30 years ago, sir, and have returned only for visits,
ground on Roosevelt's high, insistent voice.
For more than visits, I'm afraid, James said sadly.
You were of age to join the army during the Civil War, but you never did, said Roosevelt
with an oddly triumphant tone, a chess master moving his knight to a threatening position. Henry James's usually cool gray eyes flashed heat.
My younger brothers, Wilkie and Bob, were